From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand. It was late last night in Spokane, Washington, when figure skater Sasha Cohen took a big step in her bid to compete in the Winter Olympics for a third time. She is 25 years old now. She placed second in the short program at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. Our regular sports commentator, Stefan Fatsis, joins us now to discuss that and other Olympic matters. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, women's figure skating seems to grab the headlines every 4 years. It's quite popular. This year seems to be no exception with Sasha Cohen. And, well, she did pretty well last night for an old lady.
Yes, she did. It was really sort of a big take that to all of these teenagers that are challenging her. And also these doubting fans and reporters who love to create drama in figure skating. And shortly after winning the silver medal in Turin in 2006, Cohen stopped skating competitively. Then she began a comeback, but she had some injuries. She dropped out of events and she talked very little, which only fed the media machine. Then last night, she skated a clean, typically graceful performance. The crowd loved it. She's second behind a 16-year-old Mirai Nagasu and just ahead of a 17-year-old Rachel Flatt.
So pretty exciting for people to watch out here on the West Coast, but pretty difficult for you guys out there in the East.
Yeah, it was. Cohen didn't finish skating until around 2 a.m. Eastern time this morning. And the scheduling was curious, given how much figure skating and Olympics broadcaster NBC are banking on Cohen for a competitive and an audience revival. There just aren't that many stars right now in the sport, so much so that the United States qualified to send just two women instead of three to Vancouver next month. And the spots will be determined tomorrow when Cohen and the others skate their long programs, and that will be in prime time on NBC from 9 to 11.
Okay, let's talk about the business of the Olympics. NBC recently announced it will lose probably around $200 million on the Olympics. That seems like a pretty staggering figure, $200 million.
Yeah, plain and simple, NBC overbid for these games. They paid $820 million. They made this deal 7 years ago. That was $207 million more than it had paid for the Turin games. Now, NBC anticipated that advertising would continue to grow. The network would turn a profit, as it almost always has on the Olympics. Instead, we get a recession, a collapse of some key advertising sectors like autos and finance, consolidation in beer and telecoms. NBC will show 435 hours of coverage on broadcasting cable, plus another 400 hours online. And that does translate to more sales opportunities, but it can't make up for the decline in the advertising market, and the online sales market just isn't mature enough to make much of a difference.
And then there's that little late night problem. But anyway, you were at the last Winter Olympics and you got to know some of the athletes then. Any of them coming back for the Vancouver Games?
Yeah, a bunch of them are. One guy that's coming back that I talked to for a while was Todd Ludwig. He's a Nordic combined skier. That's the ski jumping and cross country skiing. And I watched him cry at the end of what was supposed to be his last race after four Olympics. And, well, Ludwig decided to come out of retirement. And now he's a favorite to become the first American ever to medal in Nordic combined. One of my other favorite athletes was a woman named Sarah Conrad. She was 38 years old at the time, the first American to compete in two separate winter events, cross-country skiing and biathlon. She has retired, but she's going to be at the Games as a volunteer working with athletes as part of the U.S. delegation.
And Stephanie, you always hear about how participating in the Olympics is life-changing for the athletes. Is that true?
I think it is. I spoke this morning with a luger named Samantha Retrosi, whom I wrote about in Turin, where she crashed just horribly in front of her terrified parents. Retrosi decided to retire shortly afterward, not because of the crash, but because she wanted to move on with her life. Most people don't think about how all-consuming it is to be an Olympian. Retrosi was 11 when she started lugeing. Now she's 24. She's a college junior, an aspiring journalist, and she's very clear that being an Olympian has made her more driven, focused, and determined, and more mature. She said that after you've been an Olympian, it's kind of hard to relate to the concerns of the typical undergraduate.
Okay, thank you, Stefan.
Thanks, Madeline.
Stefan Fatsis joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatto. Immediately after the earthquake hit in Haiti, there was a flood of information about how to help, how to donate on Facebook, how to tweet cash or text donations. It was a new, more social media method of giving. just how does the technology of texting donations work? How really? What is going on there? That's all we'll be talking about. And more importantly, is this a new lasting trend? Is social media the philanthropy of the future? Will technology help social media? Will Twitter replace the tin cup? Timothy Ogden is the editor-in-chief of the journal Philanthropy Action. He joins us today from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. And in Second Life, you can join the folks over there in the conversation. Timothy, how does it work? When you send out a tweet or something like that, how does the money go from one place to the other?
Primarily what we're talking about here is giving by text message via cell phones. And so the way that works is a service provider makes an arrangement with the carriers for a specific number that you can text the message to. And they set up an automatic system that if you text a word to that number, it asks the carrier to bill the person who sent the text, to bill the phone line, for a pre-specified amount, either $5 or $10.
So it's going through your phone line. It's going through your telephone company.
It's going through your cellular phone company. So it's essentially being added directly to your cell phone bill that you'd get at the end of the month, just like any other month, is your cell phone bill will be $10 higher.
Does all the money go through, or does the phone company take a bit of that itself?
Typically, the phone company is making its money off of its charges for SMS texting. So most phone companies charge something for the texts themselves. Now, in this case, because of public pressure, by and large, the companies have waived those fees. And also, typically, the service provider, there is an organization, for instance, called MGive that's handling the Red Cross's text donations, they have also agreed to waive their fees. So in this case, the $10 is going to the Red Cross or some of the charities because of the pretty terrific response and for people's expectations that companies shouldn't be profiting in a time of such dramatic need.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is starting a new kind of philanthropy?
Well, I think the trend is a lot less than it might appear to be. Really what we're seeing is just the adoption of another way of doing financial transactions.
Right.
It's, for instance, trying to imply trends based on the changing mix between the use of checks and credit cards at the grocery store. Really what we're talking about is just a different technology for doing the same thing that people have typically done. Now, the one thing that changes here slightly, there are two things I would say that change here slightly. One, very much to the benefit of giving, and one which is probably not so good. In the first case, the immediacy of being able to give by text really does probably have an influence. All of us human beings are subject to the most powerful force in the universe, procrastination.
Yeah.
And so the ability to give at the moment you hear does generally raise participation rates. Lots of people would plan to give but just not get around to it if they couldn't do it right away. Hmm. The flip side of that is givers via text don't engage in the same way with the charity that they're giving to. So the charities who receive a text donation are prohibited from contacting the donor. In fact, the only information they get is the donor's phone number and the carrier they use, and they agree not to contact that donor unless the donor explicitly agrees.
Mm-hmm.
And the figures that we're getting there are around 10% of donors actually agree to form some sort of relationship. So from the charity's perspective, for their ability to follow up and help that donor understand what was done with their money, what good they're doing with that money, it becomes much more difficult with a text donation versus, say, if the person came to the Red Cross's website, put in their name and their credit card number, then the Red Cross knows who that person is and has a much easier way of contacting them to follow up, to let them know what's been happening with their donation.
But this does make it easier for all kinds of foundations or nonprofits to raise money now. They see how successful you can be with a text message.
Well, again, I think there's a danger there in interpreting too much from this. You know, disasters like this are unique, and it's not necessarily a lesson that's applicable to very many other situations or very many other charities. So let me give you an example of a similar technology change related to social media, is that, you know, a lot of charities have rushed into in the last year and a half into sort of attempting to raise money via social media, be that Facebook or Twitter, because there were a couple of programs that raised a very large amount of money. A lot of people have pointed to an organization called Charity Water. Certainly people have pointed to the Obama campaign and their success with fundraising. We did a survey last year of mid-sized nonprofits about their efforts in social media, and found that 80% of them had managed to raise $100 or less through their social media efforts. And so people see a couple of instances of big success.
Yeah.
And assume that, well, that means that raising money by Facebook is the way to get a lot of money. Or in this case, I think a lot of people will start assuming, well, raising money via text messaging is an easy way to increase our donations. But in last year, the largest single text donation campaign raised $420,000.
Mm-hmm.
This year, because of this Haiti situation, the Red Cross alone has raised, I believe, a little over $30 million.
Wow.
And so, to me, that's not a sign of a trend. That's a sign of a unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll likely see something like this the next time there's a major disaster that captures attention. But between now and then, let's face it, how many good reasons are there to give with that sense of immediacy, if it's not a disaster?
Well, I'm talking on a personal level. You know, here in the streets of New York and other major cities all over, you see people who are panhandling.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a coffee cup or something like that to put your change in. Are they going to be wearing a little tweet number around their neck now? Or a
certainly.
Text that you want to send me, 99 cents, I'll take it that way.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the things, so you look at historically, is that the way these things used to happen is people came to your door.
Right.
I don't know if you remember when the Red Cross actually used to collect donations door-to-door, or the UNICEF boxes at Halloween.
Sure.
That kids carried door-to-door.
And right behind the Fuller Brush Man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, that has largely gone away. The only institutional version of that I think really still exists is the Salvation Army kettle drives at Christmas time, is sort of people right there to give. And as you said, just sort of these sort of random organizations walking around the street with buckets at intersections. I think we are, for that immediate giving, moving to the using of new technology, but just in the same way we're transacting a lot more business in that same way,
mm-hmm.
People being able to pay for anything they buy with their cell phone.
Let's see if we can get a phone call in before we go. Mark in Kansas City. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The person, your guest, was speaking about one of the downsides of accepting text donations. Unless a person opts in to receive more information, they can't get back to that donor to let them know how that money is spent. Quite frankly, I believe that most donors like that part of it, because getting back to you to tell you how the money is spent, it really doesn't happen. And what it is, they can come back and inundate you with more requests all the time for more money. If a person gives to that foundation or the Haiti Relief or something, I think they have a pretty good idea where the money's going. So being anonymous, if you will, is a heck of a benefit, because then you're not inundated and you can choose who you're giving your money to and when you're giving it.
And anonymity is the mantra of the Internet. It's the mantra of the digital world. No one knows who you are.
No one knows who you are, although your privacy typically is a lot less than most people actually presume that it is.
Well, yeah, I'm not worried about the privacy part of it. I just... And I believe most people aren't worried about that. They get calls all the time. Then if you give somebody $50, an organization, and you really want to support them, you'll probably get 10, 12 calls during the year for another 50 for another reason. And it just gets to be irritating after a while.
Yeah, I mean,
so
you're pointing out a real problem. You're pointing out a real problem of the charity sector as a whole, which is they have focused their communications with donors not on the effectiveness of what they've done, but on additional fundraising appeals. And they've lost the trust of a lot of donors because of that. And as you said, a lot of them are frustrated and don't want to hear from the charities.
You know, I was talking about the folks with carrying little cups around the city, and you were looking at that as a institutional, and I was looking at that as a personal way to donate. If you find someone who you really want to just send money to them, and you just have to find out how to text it to them, and they have to have some way of receiving it. And you may see them on the news, you know, a family that's lost its house in a fire, other kinds of tragedies. And now maybe that's becoming a little more personal.
Yeah, and, you know, personal giving, the person-to-person connections and philanthropy, I think, is, in fact, a major trend of people being able to expect to connect a lot more directly. But it is also a double-edged sword. You know, for the people on the receiving end, right, there are things we do have to really worry about creating dependency, about making sure that money is used well and delivered in exactly the right ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's an upside of the person-to-person connection because it can enable, a lot more of a generous feeling from people and a lot more accountability, and that's great. But it can also create these really troubling dynamics between people in need and people who give. And even in the best of times, some of that can turn into both either dependency or control, you know, the attempt by givers to control the behavior of recipients in ways that really aren't helpful for anyone in the long term.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to thank you very much for taking time out with us. And I imagine we'll be seeing more of this kind of giving in the future as people.
Absolutely. The mechanisms of all of our financial transactions are going to be changing dramatically, and that's going to include charity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tim. Thanks again. Have a good weekend. Tim Ogden is the editor-in-chief of the journal Philanthropy Action, and he was talking to us from Westchester, Pennsylvania.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In 2006, Gita Anand published a book called The Cure, How a Father Raised $100 Million and Bucked the Medical Establishment in a Quest to Save His Children. The book's now a film called Extraordinary Measures, starring Brendan Fraser and Harrison Ford. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
There's a basic tension in the true-ish documentary Extraordinary Measures that lifts it above the formula disease of the week picture. Brendan Fraser plays John Crowley, an executive at Bristol-Myers Squibb with a daughter and son who have the rare Pompe disease, a cousin to muscular dystrophy that fatally weakens muscles, including the biggie, the heart. Although Crowley works for Big Pharma, there's no discussion in the movie of his particular company doing research for a cure. Pompe is an orphan disease, which means a giant pharmaceutical or biotech entity has little financial incentive to pursue a treatment. Instead, the distraught Crowley tracks down Robert Stonehill, played by Harrison Ford, a cranky scientist in Nebraska with big ideas but few resources. With the clock ticking on his children's lives, Crowley forms a company with Stonehill and goes in search of venture capital. He has to convince corporate bottom-liners that, despite his personal stake, he can be objective. He can coolly calculate profit margins and patient acceptable loss percentages. When a bigger company buys his own and there's finally a drug to test, he learns his dying daughter and son are too old for the first wave of trials. The real Crowley, as portrayed in Wall Street Journal reporter Gita Anand's 2006 book, The Cure, might even agree with Michael Moore on the doggone unfairness of it all. But he rarely questions the economic system that both makes him and his partners rich and would let his kids die. The screenplay by Robert Nelson Jacobs doesn't address that dichotomy directly either, but it hits it much harder. Jacobs and director Tom Vaughn build nearly every scene in the movie around it. Ford's character Stonehill is fictional, a composite allegedly, and his confrontations with Crowley, whom he calls Jersey, come down to pure science versus the marketplace. It's a nasty moment when Crowley informs Stonehill he's selling the company.
What are you doing?
Giving you a preview
of what's going to happen
if we are not in clinical trials in 4 months. Our investors will turn out the lights.
Science takes time, Jersey. Don't they understand?
Yeah, they do. They can read the Wall Street Journal. They see that Zymogen is testing 3 different Pompe drugs.
They're testing 3 because they don't know what the hell they're doing. I'm testing 1 because it's the right one.
I know. I believe you, Bob.
Look, I want you to go toe-to-toe with Zymogen scientists. That's the reason I've entered into conversations with them to buy our company.
You're telling me? You're not asking me?
Oh, come on, Bob. I am just
being fiscally responsible.
Nobody's gonna tell me how to run my lab.
If I can engineer a deal, and that is a really big if, you're going to have to forgive me for all the money I'm gonna make you.
I don't care about money. I'm a scientist. I care about more important things than that.
Don't you tell me about more important things to care about.
That scene is very Hollywood, and Extraordinary Measures comes on as a conventionally inspiring story of courage and determination. But as in the recent Will Smith vehicle, The Pursuit of Happiness, the filmmakers attempt to strike a balance between good, old-fashioned Horatio Alger capitalist hustle and the primal dread of not being able to protect one's children. Anyway, I cried. A lot. I'm a sucker for kids on ventilators wasting away. When Crowley tells his little blonde daughter in the ICU with a tube in her arm that he'll find a special medicine to save her, she makes him promise it will be pink. Dark pink, not light pink, which is babyish. That killed me. And while Extraordinary Measures has a soppy piano and string score, the fear under every scene gives the film an edge. Frasier doesn't suggest the drive of the real Crowley, who looks like a cross between Tom Cruise and Steve Carell, but he's such a haggard lump of vulnerability that my heart went out to him. Harrison Ford's company bought the right to Gita Anand's book, and the role of Stonehill has been made to fit his mature temperament, which is to say he barks a lot and never cracks a smile. Something bilious in Ford seems to have taken over and worn him down to sinews and sourness. He's not especially convincing as an eccentric, obsessive scientist who blasts rock and roll while scrawling equations. For one thing, he looks like he works out too much. But he is the star who made Extraordinary Measures possible. If the film does well and Pompe disease gets more attention and more funding, well, that's the showbiz side of capitalism that strives for a balance between box office and beneficence.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand. The words repeated multiple times by President Obama today, "I won't stop fighting." He was on a trip to Ohio to talk about jobs and the economy. His trip capped off a nightmare week for the White House and for Democrats. The loss of one Senate seat from Massachusetts has thrown the president's top priorities into disarray. In a moment, we'll dissect the damage with our regular political commentators. First, NPR's Don Gagne reports on the president's visit to the town of Elyria.
Northeast Ohio has seen steel and other manufacturing jobs disappear. And the president came here to answer those who say he's not done enough for working people in his first year in office.
If you ask the average person what was the Recovery Act, the stimulus package, they'd say the bank bailout. So let me just be clear here. The Recovery Act was cutting taxes for 95% of working families, 15 different tax cuts for working families, 7 different tax cuts for small businesses so they can start up and grow and hire.
The president said he's not given up on overhauling health care. He cited his proposals this week to put tough new restrictions on banking practices and noted that he's accused of interfering with banks.
No, I just want to have some rules in place so that when these guys make dumb decisions, you don't end up having to foot the bill.
The president took questions from the audience. One came from a woman who owns a truck driving school that's hurting.
In the past few months, we've had a number of people on a daily basis coming into our school that's unemployed, but there are no training funds for truck driver training. And I want to know why that has changed.
The president said he couldn't specifically address her situation, though he said the stimulus package does contain retraining money. Then he used the moment to take on another common criticism of his administration.
You know, Obama's just trying to perpetrate big government. What big government exactly that we've been trying to perpetrate here? We're trying to fund those guys who want to go to truck driving school. We want to make sure that they've got some money to get trained for a job in the private sector.
The president always tells his audiences he enjoys getting out of Washington. This week, he seemed genuinely thrilled to get back to the scenes and themes of his campaign days. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me as always. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Michelle. Well, last week we spoke with Ada Calhoun, and Michelle, she told us that she recently came out of the closet as a Christian to her circle of non-believing friends. Our conversation was a follow-up to a piece she wrote for Salon.com titled, I Am a Closet Christian. I caught up with blogger Paul, and I can't say that he had much sympathy for Calhoun's dilemma.
Once again, the majority has a very small taste of what it feels like to be a minority. It is still almost a death knell to admit you are a doubter in most circles in this country. The dominant assumption is always that you believe in God. Why not have an astrologer on as well? Ridiculous.
All right, thanks, Paul. But we also heard from Aldry, who posted this. She writes, Miss Calhoun, please don't feel like you have to impress people who don't believe like you and that you have to hide it. Who knows? You might just help out someone struggling with their faith, and your words may be of strong encouragement to them.
Thank you, Aldry. And Lee, now to last week's earthquake, which has devastated the capital of Haiti and killed tens of thousands of people. In a recent blog post, Tell Me More producer Jasmine Garst questioned whether some of the graphic images being shown of those killed in the earthquake crossed the line between news and sensationalism. Well, lots of people wanted to respond to Jasmine's post. Here's her perspective from Gar, who posted to our site.
I believe it is completely impossible to cross the line when showing images from a disaster. Images convey often what words cannot. The imagery by the likes of NPR photographers and the press will give the viewing public what it does not want to see, but perhaps inspire greater aid from the United Nations and those countries who can give what the Haitians do not have.
Thank you, Gar. And Lee, Jasmine also probed the role that race plays in determining what images from which disasters are published by the media. To that point, here's a post from blogger James. He writes, it's a further sign that people of color are still seen as less than human and not worthy of the same respect afforded to whites or Americans. Compare how many images were shown of those killed in the 9/11 attacks. I never saw one horrific image of human carnage as those coming out of Haiti. Thank you, Paul. Lee? Any updates?
Yeah, Michelle, just one update. Last fall, we reported a disturbing story out of Richmond, California, where a young girl was allegedly gang-raped outside her high school's homecoming dance. Reportedly, this all happened as passers-by watched. Well, Tuesday, a seventh suspect accused in the rape, 43-year-old John Crane Jr., turned himself in to Richmond authorities.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log onto our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.